Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Author Chat, hosted by Elizabeth Kelly. In each episode, we talk with writers about their recent works. What inspired them? What challenges did they face? And what impact will their work have on your life?
Welcome to Author Chat. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today we are honored to have with us Andrea Dean Lyon, Dean of the Valparaiso University Law School, to discuss with us her recent book, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive. Welcome, Andrea.
Oh, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks so much for joining us here on Author Chat. The title of your book is The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive? What, Andrea, is keeping the death penalty alive in America?
It's a complicated question, and it's a combination of different things which I explore in the book, having to do with our culture and our history. And in particular, and the focus of the book is on the political nature of the death penalty, of its use as a way of keeping people's attention focused on simple stories like bad guys and good guys instead of complex stories like climate change. And so it's a combination of those things, although I am optimistic that it won't stay alive too much longer here in this country.
Can we draw some generalizations in this country about the geographic divisions between those parts of the country that support the death penalty and those that don't?
Well, yes and no. The death belt, as it's referred to sometimes, is primarily a southern phenomena. Looking at what happened in South Carolina this week and, you know, all of the racial tensions, there is a connection. And another thing that I discuss is a connection between race, lynching, and the death penalty. But it is not just a southern phenomena. One of the states that does a lot of killing is Ohio. Oklahoma, other states like that. So it's not entirely a southern phenomena, but the majority of the states that sentence and execute are in the South or below the Mason-Dixon line.
You mentioned South Carolina a few moments ago, and for those of our listeners who will be listening to the show in archive, we are doing this show on June 24th. And Andrea, I'm particularly struck, as I'm sure many people are, by the moving statements of the victims' families at the bond hearing last Friday, telling Dylan Roof that they forgive him. How do you square that forgiveness with the statements by politicians in South Carolina, namely their governor, Nikki Haley, calling out for the death penalty in this crime?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, is that the death penalty, if you debate the death penalty on its merits, if you debate it on whether it deters crime, you discover that there's no evidence that it does. And in fact, the only evidence of any appreciable effect of executions is that crime seems to go up in states where there's been an execution by a few percentage points, violent crime, right after an execution. Or if you debate it on the, cost, if you debate it on any of the sort of objective issues, the abolitionists have it. Nonetheless, the issue that is usually brought by proponents of the death penalty is sort of the just deserts. Some people just don't deserve to breathe the air kind of feeling that people have about, certain offenses and offenders. And what's interesting is that people with those strong feelings are not always who you think they would be. They are not always the remaining family members of victims. In fact, there's an entire national organization called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation that opposes the death penalty and does not want this sort of vengeance. And so it is a stark contrast, I agree, between the people who are most affected by what happened and what, you know, Mr. Roof did after inexplicably sitting there in prayer meeting for an hour to all of those people. It's that they are willing to forgive him shows a nobility of spirit that does not seem to be mirrored by the politicians in the state.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Andrea Lyon. Andrea is now the dean of the Valparaiso University Law School. Prior to that, she was an associate dean at DePaul University School of Law. And prior to that, she was the director of the Illinois Capital Resource Center. She is a longtime capital defender in this country, and she has been a role model for many of us who are criminal defense lawyers. Now, one of the stories in your book, Andrea, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive, is the story of a gentleman by the name of Madison Hobley. Who was mm-hmm. Mr. Hobley, and why did you include this story in your book?
Well, Madison Hobley, Matt, as we most of us call him, was my client. He was on Illinois' death row and was wrongfully convicted. And eventually we were able to free him. But the reason that I chose to tell his story is that his story is emblematic of all the things that go wrong in the death penalty, of false and coerced confessions, sort of racial divisions, white police officer's word against the black man, of the procedural nightmares you can fall into because if someone didn't object at the right time in the right way, you can never get to the issue. It's so, procedurally complicated that there are technicalities that can kill you as opposed to free you, unlike in the popular media. And because he is very much an everyman. And what I mean by that is he's just an ordinary person. I don't mean to say it like that. He was not a criminal or a gang member or living a dangerous life. He was a medical technician married with a child. His child and wife burned up in an arson, and he survived, and so they decided he did it. And it's emblematic of all the things that can go wrong, with a jury that did not understand they didn't have to give the death penalty, with a coerced misconduct in the jury room, with a suburban police officer who was on the jury, don't ask me why he was, but he was, coming in on the third or fourth day of deliberation and putting his gun on the table and telling everyone they were going to have a verdict that day. Things like that. And I felt that telling his story would help people to coalesce in their minds all the things that are wrong with our attempts to, using the famous quote, tinker with the machinery of death. It's just always a failure.
You spoke a few moments ago about technicalities. Several months ago, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine, not an attorney, but a woman who was very well-versed about the criminal justice system. And what she found so difficult to believe is how almost impossible it is to overturn a wrongful conviction, even in cases of actual innocence. Why is that?
Well, that's a good question. Part of that is the expansion of federal habeas into state convictions, which occurred after World War II primarily, is viewed much the way a lot of things are viewed in the South as part of, quote, northern aggression. And so there's this huge resistance to attempting to correct actual error through the federal courts, and an enormous amount of deference that's given to state court. And so you have to be able to show that no rational trier of fact, no rational judge or jury could possibly find the defendant guilty in order to overturn the conviction in federal court. In state court, it's very difficult politically because most of our state judiciary, particularly in death penalty states, are elected. And elected judges are afraid to look, quote, soft on crime. You need look no further than the state of Alabama to see what I mean, as Alabama has judge override, where the judge can, for any or no reason, override the jury verdict of life or death. And over half the men on Alabama's death row, about 75 or 80 of them, got life from juries and had them overruled and death verdicts imposed by judges.
And judicial override has been found constitutional by the United States Supreme Court?
It has been found constitutional by the United States Supreme Court. Alabama is now an outlier. You know, Florida does have judicial override. It requires a finding and meeting certain standards that Alabama does not. My state, Indiana, used to have judicial override, but that was changed statutorily about 6 years ago. But yes, it is considered constitutional. There, of course, are many scholars who think that it shouldn't be constitutional, that if the idea is that the judgment of the people of the state, and by the way, only the people of the state who believe in the death penalty can sit on such a jury. Anyone who's against it can't sit there. And they choose life, that should be the end of the question. And many people feel that way, including me. But it is, in fact, constitutional and continues.
Your book, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive, is a relatively small book. It's less than 200 pages. That's not to say that it's not substantial. Who, Andrea, is the audience for your book?
Well, I'm hoping that in addition to lawyers and folks that do the kind of work that we do, criminal defense lawyers, that this would be a book that would be accessible and helpful to people who are interested in the subject, either because they're interested in criminal justice or they're interested in true crime or because they're interested in politics. And I endeavored in writing the book to make it not too technical and not too sort of scholarly or academic the way that you might in a legal textbook, in order that it would be accessible, say, to a college student who might understand exactly what the process is having read it and what are the things that affect the death penalty and its imposition in the United States.
And in the meantime, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive, is richly footnoted, and if a reader is inspired to seek out additional information and additional sources, that reader can certainly do so. Final question for you, Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
Attorneys in general suffer from a high degree of burnout and even substance abuse. Criminal defense lawyers are particularly vulnerable. What advice would you give to a criminal defense lawyer about achieving balance? That is to say, on the one hand, taking care of him or herself, but on the other hand, taking care of clients and still maintaining standards of excellence.
Well, that's a very difficult balance to maintain. You know, you want to be human and humane enough to allow yourself to care about what happens to your client. And yet you want to also maintain sufficient objectivity that you can see straight and that you can give good advice and don't become so emotionally connected. You don't want to be too connected or too unconnected. And it's a very, very difficult balance to strike. And there are a couple of things that make a difference in my view. One of them is expressing what you feel when you feel it. And I don't mean in court necessarily, but if you're horrified by the crime or if you're upset about what you hear about your client's, you know, horrible life story, it's better to get it out than to keep it in where it can fester and start to hurt you or have you take refuge in alcohol or some other kind of drug. So that's one thing. The other thing is to take care of yourself physically, and that means to get enough sleep and to do some kind of exercise that you like, whatever that might be, and to just make sure that you're strong enough physically to handle it. But the most important thing, in my view, to keep you in balance is it has to matter to you personally. You cannot sell what you wouldn't buy. And if you don't care about your client's life, if it's just a job for you, get out. Don't do it. Because a jury can read when you're phoning it in and when you mean it. And that does mean it costs you more. It does mean that it can hurt, you know, you more as you watch what's going on in court, as you watch, you know, everyone who looks like your client being excused peremptorily from the jury by the prosecution, as you watch judges roll their eyes when you stand up to cross-examine because they don't want you to cross-examine, when you watch the, you know, playing it for the press or for the television camera. It's very difficult to allow yourself to care, but you have to, because that is how you bring the jury with you so that they can care too. You know, it's interesting, Elizabeth, a lot of times people say to me, you know, what do you do to humanize your client? You know, maybe you've gotten that question yourself.
All the time.
And what I say to them is, my client is human. It's the jury I'm worried about. You know, they're the ones that need to get back to their humanity and to not see this case and this client as a cardboard cutout in a comic book, but as a human being who is, after all, not only the worst thing they've ever done in their life.
Not by any means. And many times, by the time we represent a client, he or she has been horribly, horribly damaged by so many of life's circumstances.
Yeah, that's been my experience.
We've been talking with Andrea Lyon, Dean of the Valparaiso University Law School, about her powerful and compelling new book, The Death Penalty, What's Keeping It Alive. Thanks so much for joining us here on Author Chats, Andrea.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all of my listeners. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.